to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, together with Susan Franzen. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Greta, and hello to you, the listener.
Later in the show, we hear how a curious tradition of design coffins got started in the suburbs of Accra, the capital of Ghana.
There was this old woman of my grandfather who always see the airplanes flying, and she was like, I would really love to fly in one of those airplanes, but she never got to do it. So my grandfather, being a very important carpenter in the family, had to build a coffin, and he came up with the idea of building a coffin in the shape of an airplane.
So, Susan, you've consulted the tea leaves. Can we expect this great fall weather to continue?
Well, if we get through today, it looks like a good week ahead, with highs around the 70s and more sunshine. Rain is not predicted to return until Friday or Saturday.
It was particularly nice yesterday.
And that was a big day for you.
Well, big for Ames, and even bigger for my husband, who actually worked around the clock on Saturday night to make sure all the computers were working before the grand reopening of the Ames Public Library.
Was the opening well attended?
Oh, yes. Literally hundreds of people gathered around the entrance for the opening words by Mayor Ann Campbell and others. There was a two-man oompa band, adding to the sense of celebration, and then smiles. The big blue dog arrived on the bookmobile to cut the red ribbon with Library Director Lynn Carey.
Sounds picture perfect.
It was very well planned.
Well, there's a lot of excitement afoot these days, not just in Ames, but all across the country.
Excitement afoot, eh?
Of course, I use that phrase advisedly. The human-powered Great March for Climate Action that has been moving step by step across America, starting back in March in L.A., is now in Indiana. And we'll be talking to our local correspondent for that, Ed Fallon, all week. They are gearing up for a few big days of activism in New York City this weekend. Hello. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm doing all right. I didn't get a great night's sleep last night. We were camping out behind a Unitarian church in Elkhart, Indiana, and tremendous hospitality. We had a wonderful potluck with the members of the church last night, and they turned out in good numbers to dialogue with us about climate action, and it went well. It was a very good conversation. You know, there's traffic, there's trains, and me being the lightest sleeper in the world, that's not very a good mix, but still, you know, I find that the best way to assure a good night's sleep is to have a bad one, so I'm looking forward to tonight catching up on what I missed last night.
Okay. Well, could you fill us in a little on where you're going from here, and just what's today like?
Well, it's about just under a 15-mile day, which for us is fairly modest. And we're going from Elkhart, Indiana, which is a bigger town than I knew, to Goshen, Indiana, which is apparently a fairly receptive community. We're going to be staying with the Mennonites there, and some folks from the college in Goshen are going to meet us as we come into town. And oftentimes we're having these dialogues with local people that I never quite know how they're going to turn out or who's going to show up, but sometimes we just have a few people. Sometimes half the town comes out.
So how many of you are there walking from place to place?
Well, it's about 35 people. And there's a few people who stay behind to make sure, in this case, make sure the church and the church grounds are all spick and span, and who will move our truck that hauls our gear and our food truck and also our eco-commodes. That's our chemical-free porta-potties that we use. Oftentimes, we have people going to speak in schools. So there'll be marchers who maybe only march part of the day because they're off talking to a class or two in the morning. Yeah, but at any given time, we've got 20, 25 people out on the road walking. And today, I think we'll see at least that many. It's a perfect day for walking, meaning it's overcast and it's cool. The sun drains you after a while on the highway.
Now, the trip to New York is obviously a little detour. Your ultimate destination in, what, November is Washington, D.C., is that right?
It is, and actually there's been a shift in my own personal plans on that. Nearly all the marchers, all but three of us, are going to New York. I'm going to stay behind with two of the other marchers who are going to be taking care of equipment and actually kind of repainting our truck so that it's good for the last mile and last month and a half. But my own problem is I'm really sore. I'm really tired. I'm worn down, and I'm concerned that I'm not going to have enough juice left in my battery to make it all the way to D.C. Going to New York from here, it means two nights on a bus. And two nights on a bus means two nights with absolutely no sleep for me. So I would come back from New York. I'm much more tired than I am right now. So I made the choice to skip that, to stay here with the march equipment and a couple of the marchers, and to rest up for that last 5 or 6 week push, and also to use that time to catch up on some writing. There have been some newspapers that want pieces from me, and I haven't had time to write those. You know, I'm not unaccustomed to burning the candle at both ends, but it's really a good idea not to do that and burn it in the middle as well. So I thought, as I pondered what my obligation was, to finish this march, and to do that, I needed to skip out on New York. But New York is going to be a fantastic experience. I mean, everything's coming together, as far as I can tell, really well, and they should have tens of thousands of people there. And that will send a really powerful message. And our marchers will be there with their shirts and promoting. They're going to be promoting the march, the Great March for Climate Action, as a next step that people can take for people who are fired up to do additional things, to keep acting, to keep moving forward. Now, we want some of those folks from the New York march to come join us. And they'll see what a real march is. None of this 3 mile stuff.
Well, could you tell us sort of what your assessment is? I mean, you sound like you're a little bit down after all of these long, long days and nights. What's the interaction with people? Do you think it's really been worth it?
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm physically tired, but I am intellectually and emotionally charged. I mean, it absolutely has been worth it. I mean, think about it. Just me, I've had 3,000 or so personal conversations, one-on-one conversations with people. A lot of them conservative, self-described political conservatives, self-described evangelical Christians who are receptive to the conversation. We may not agree all the time on everything, but for the most part, they have been in agreement that climate change is happening, that human activity is the, I believe it's the reason climate change is happening. But the fact that I'm getting from conservatives acknowledgement that, yeah, our activity is at least part of the problem, that's huge, that's significant. And then in addition to, I don't know if you can hear the singing in the background.
No, we can't hear it.
Oh, the marchers are getting ready to head out, so we're heading out with a song. Besides the one-on-one conversations, we are in the paper, on the radio, on TV all the time, day after day. Good article in the local paper here in Elkhart just a couple days ago. So I don't know how you could possibly get anywhere near that kind of press coverage if you're just if you're an organization in one spot. I mean, organizations that are located in a certain community, they're doing really important work. But in terms of the uniqueness of the outreach that we're able to accomplish, it's unprecedented. Despite how tired I am, it's absolutely worth it given the gravity of the situation.
Speaking of press coverage, you have a very unique way of keeping people abreast of what you're doing, that you do have a regular 4 p.m. program on Wednesdays. And I listened into yours last week and was very impressed with the two people that you talked with and the way they talked about how they talked to their neighbors and what their issues were in their place. And could you tell people about your podcasts also? How could people could listen into your reports?
It's from 6 to 6:30, Monday through Thursday, and it's available online at www.stalinforum.com. And then, like you said, once a week on Wednesdays at 4 o'clock, you can hear two of those programs kind of combined on KHOI 89.1. So, yeah, we take callers, too. If you're listening to the live broadcast, we always welcome people to call in. And we have some conservative callers who like to call in and continue to deny climate change. And that's always a little entertaining, and sometimes just a lot of people can't make it to New York for the People's Climate March. But I understand that CCL is putting together an event in Ames, which is exciting to hear about.
Now, CCL is Citizens Climate Lobby, right?
Right.
And their local organizer is Stephen Biggs, for those of you who might know who he is. He's a philosophy professor here, and he and his family, I guess, are planning to go to New York.
But for folks who are staying behind, there is an event in Ames. I can't remember what time it is now, but...
We'll be announcing that later this week.
Good, okay.
We're pulling this together, and we're very excited about that part of it, because one of the things that we know from past marches that weren't too popular with various administrations is that they have lousy national press coverage. And so a lot of people may be, even on Sunday, unaware of what's happening because it hasn't been announced. You get, maybe 3 or 4 minutes on the local commercial television program, and that's it. So we figure it's very important for us to bring it home.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not just the politicians that are ignoring the climate crisis. It's the press as well. And I was very disappointed to learn that in the recent debate between two candidates for Congress in Iowa, that there was not a single question asked by the press corps relevant to climate change. And these are seasoned reporters who have been around forever. And they know the issues. They should understand the critical role that Congress plays in, that Congress could play in addressing the climate crisis. And yet, not a single question was asked about climate change.
Well, isn't that one of the points of these marches? Is to make people aware so that they do start demanding that their candidates talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, there are good reporters. There are folks still in the newsrooms and in TV studios and on radio who do good work where they dig into a story and they come up with information that people need to know about, true news. And similarly, there are politicians who really provide leadership. I mean, one example on climate change in Iowa is State Senator Rob Hoeg. He's done an amazing amount of work trying to elevate the level of awareness about climate change. And yet, for the most part, the media, especially, the national media, and our political leadership, and again, especially Congress, are not really leading at all. They're beholden to corporate money, whether it's in advertising if you're in the press, or campaign contributions if you're in politics, and they're worried about their jobs, whether it's the next 2-year election cycle or the what the corporate media headquarters is saying.
One of the problems that the media has is that this is such a serious issue that people, they'd rather listen to something else. So in our coverage this week, which will continue, we're going to have some really fun activities. And you have to have some fun when you walk and walk and walk. You have to sing, you have to have some jokes, and you have to learn how to keep laughing.
Yes, that's very true.
So bye-bye. Stay here from you Wednesday.
Thank you very much.
And that was Ed Fallon, who has been telling the story of his travels across America by foot on his radio show, The Fallon Forum, which airs on KHOI every Wednesday at 4 p.m.
And once again, we'll be talking to Ed throughout the week. Speaking of sustainable means of transportation, did you see the front page story on the ISU Daily about the bike share program?
Yes, I did. And when I saw it, I was kind of curious about it and wanted to investigate. I had seen the bicycles in the window of our neighbor design on Main, just around the corner from us. The industrial design department has an outlet on Main Street, and there was a bicycle in a rack, and I was really wondering what that was. It turns out that those are the models that my next guest developed for a bike share program on campus. Mark Cargall is a graduate student. He's actually a bike designer. And he co-taught the class of ISU sophomores and juniors who spent last spring semester working out some of the details of this bike share program. I was curious about those details, so I went by and visited him. Here's Mark Cargall.
We started off looking at the campus, looking at who was using bikes. We wanted to look at how could we make this the easiest system for students to use. So one of the things we looked at was how do you check these out? The solution that the students came up with was using the RFID chips that are built into the student ID cards. That already accesses databases in place on campus. Students who are currently enrolled would already be in that database to be able to use the bikes.
That seems to solve a difficult problem that a citywide program might have.
Sure. The current bike share systems that are out there in cities, there's different ways that you would access them. You can buy a membership where you would prepay and purchase a membership, have a card, go to the kiosk, slide your card, and be able to then go check out a bike. But many people don't go that route. Maybe they're visiting a city, Washington, D.C., for example. Many of the people that use the bike share system there are visitors. So they have to go to the kiosk, put in their credit card, go through multiple screens with waivers and agreements, and finally are given a piece of paper with a 4-digit code on it that they then can go over to the bike. And hopefully it unlocks. From our experience with the systems in Chicago, which are made by the same company, usually you're entering the number 4 or 5 times in order to get it to finally unlock. A bike share system like this, cards could be issued for membership, and at that point it would have an RFID chip or a keychain, bracelets. Different ideas have been tossed out there as far as what that would look like. And the user would then be able to just go up to the rack that has a bike in it, swipe their keychain or their card, and the bike would unlock.
Did you have to think about things like, okay, in some cases, a lot of bikes might show up at the same place at the same time. They won't have as many stands to be stuck in. What was the stand-to-bike ratio that you had thought about?
Right. So the standard is pretty much 2 bike racks for every bike that's in the system. So you'd have a rack to start from and a rack to end at. Part of the studies is looking at distribution of students on campus throughout the day, different times of the day, and looking at where are the greatest concentrations of students that would be using an area. As far as moving them around, because you're right, one of the biggest problems in bike share systems is the redistribution of the bikes when they all end up in one spot. And with our system on campus, the proposal was to allow students to move those bikes around. The way we would do this is using a phone application, and students could sign up on this phone app to be a bicycle jockey. And they would receive a notification telling them that they have too many bikes at one location and they need to have 5 bikes moved to another location. And those students could accept that job, go over, pick up the bike, ride it to the new location, put it in the rack. Once the job was completed, they would get credited with some SciCash, which is essentially a debit card system that's built into our ID cards.
That does solve a problem. Someone could get a good workout and make a little SciCash at the same time.
Many of the cities that have bike share systems are using large trucks to go around, and they'll pick up a few bikes and move them to another location. And we just felt like, as a sustainability initiative, that putting a truck on campus to drive around and move bikes around doesn't really make sense.
Are there any towns that have opted for a low-tech distribution system for their bike share programs?
So Grinnell College has a bike share program, but what they have done is purchased a bunch of bicycles, and they painted them all the same color. And they are available for their students to use whenever. There's no accountability with them. They are around campus, and you can grab one if it's sitting there. Many times they're thrown into the bushes, and you just pick it up and go. There's no locks. It's a much smaller community. They're not so worried about the theft on campus there. Other colleges have done similar programs where they've issued locks to people who have joined their bike share system. We proposed that the bike share system would be available for every student. It would be paid for through student fees, similar to their SciRide access. Everybody would have the access to it and could use it without having to worry about, well, I didn't purchase the membership. So,
is SciRide a potential partner?
SciRide knows where students are coming from and where they need to go, and they are extremely overcrowded at this point. We feel that this system could be a way to reduce the crowding on SciRide. I would love for SciRide to be involved in this project. whether they would be the administrators of it or if it were a different group, I feel like they definitely need to be part of this. This should supplement and enhance the SciRide system versus trying to compete with it.
That is the voice of Mark Cargall in the Industrial Design Department of ISU.
So what was the article in the Daily about?
Well, there was a bump in the road. This project, a bike share program on campus, was commissioned by last year's GSB, or Government of the Student Body. But this year's GSB chose not to fund the program. Evidently, it was a close and hotly contested vote.
Part of the goal for this semester was to build working prototypes. So last semester, the students worked on the design of the racks, how the phone app might work, the interface between a person and the rack, and then the design the bikes as well. The bikes that were designed last year were built as full-scale models. They were not rideable. So what we wanted to do this year was take and develop those to the point where they are rideable bikes made out of the right materials, the right parts, exactly what Iowa State would be putting on campus once they go to implement. We were asking for approximately $7,000 from Government of the Student Body to fund this semester's work.
And did you get any sense of why they did not go forward with that funding?
The biggest thing that I heard was the Government of the Student Body was uneasy about funding the development of the prototypes when they did not have a feasibility study in their hands at the time. So they didn't want to fund prototypes without knowing if the system could even work on campus, which is part of this semester's project as well.
Well, there's a classic catch-22. So what are the steps now? Are you going to go ahead and do a feasibility study with no funding? What are you going to do to forward this project?
We are moving forward. We're going on just as if we would have been funded. The Industrial Design Department has contributed $5,000. We're also pursuing other funding sources.
Have you thought about expanding this into the City of Ames?
We would love to see the City of Ames implement the bike share program as well. The people we have talked to within the City of Ames are wanting to see what we come up with first and not really wanting to be a part of it at this point. I do feel like it makes sense for the campus and the City of Ames to be together on this project in the future.
From your design perspective, would it take that much for citizens of Ames who don't have these cards to use the same system that you might develop in the future?
It would just be a matter of having access to the database. So cards could be sold through the city hall, and then once that card was entered into the system, it would be able to be used at all of the bike racks.
Well, I wish you luck on the continuation of this program, and we'll see what the future holds.
Thank you very much.
How could I forget to mention a bicycle is a good invention? Sitting there in a silent movie beside the only girl who really ever knew me. Happy days but sad facing. Heaven knows I'm on the case. Oh, how could I forget to mention a bicycle?
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're your hosts, Susan Franzen and Greta Anderson.
And we just heard Mark Cargall of ISU Industrial Design Program. He and his group are still working hard on the bike share program. Our next guest is an artist from Ghana who is at the top of his field. Eric Ajite Anang is a design coffin artist from Ghana. And he is on the Iowa State campus this week to lead a workshop in which Iowa State students will build a coffin shaped like an ear of corn.
A coffin shaped like an ear of corn? Well, that sounds amazing to me.
That's a good one, Susan. Well, actually, coffin making has become serious business in Ghana. Eric is joined by Chris Martin, an ISU faculty member who spent 2 years in Ghana in the Peace Corps. Chris is Eric's host for the week, both on campus and off. It is Chris's furniture making class that will be carving this coffin. What's really amazing is that this design coffin industry is not some centuries-old tradition among the Ghanaians. This is something Eric's grandfather came up with. Here's Eric describing what happened.
What I basically do is I build coffins in a design form. And this was something which was basically started by my grandfather. in the early 50s. So it's normally a palanquin. Until in the early 50s, he changed the whole idea into a coffin. A palanquin is a kind of seat they used to carry the chiefs in during festivals.
And then that would be carved in such a way that would reflect characteristics of this leader.
Yes. So among the Gans, we normally have our palanquins in the shape of animals that represent the clan. So like a particular clan has a kind of fish or a lion or an eagle. So usually during the festivals or funerals, they used to come out with the chiefs riding in them and dancing and, you know, displaying their sort of power they have in the community. So like, let's say we are in Accra and there is a funeral in Labadi, which is the, it is a suburb of Accra. So the chief of Teshin, when he has to move in his palanquin in the shape of an eagle. Oh. And then we have the land founders of Teshin, who happens to have the symbol of the spider. So he is, of course, not a chief, but they were the forefathers of the land. They bought the land. So he rides in the palanquin in the shape of a spider. On the other hand, when you go to other tribes, they have other forms like the crocodile, the lions, and other animals. Yeah.
Okay. And so there was a chief at one point who decided that these symbolic representations, these carvings, should be used for coffins rather than chairs.
Okay, so what actually happened was my grandfather was actually building a palanquin in the shape of a cocoa pod for a chief to ride in.
A cocoa pod. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So he was building the palanquin in the shape of a cocoa pod for this chief to ride in. But this chief passed away before the palanquin was finished. So my grandfather decided to convince the family if they could change the whole idea of using that as a palanquin. Since that represents the clan, he could change the form from being a palanquin into a coffin. So during that time, the more important thing was they have a very short period in preparing the body for burial. You have like 4 or 5 days. So when he said that to the family, they were very much convinced, and he managed to do that within 5 days. So this chief was buried in the palanquin as a coffin. People were really much amazed, but what they were thinking was it's only meant for chiefs. Until in 1951, there was this old woman of my grandfather who always see the aeroplanes flying, and she was like, I would really love to fly in one of those aeroplanes, but she never got to do it. So my grandfather, being a very important carpenter in the family, had to build a coffin, and he came up with the idea of building a coffin in the shape of an aeroplane within 5 days. So people were really amazed because this old woman was not representing the community, but she was just a mere old woman. So people living along the coast then realized it could go for any other person. So they then started to go to him at the backyard of the family house to commission for their own coffins and then also coffins for their deceased relatives. So that was how he actually began. And little by little, he managed to buy a land along the road and then settle there with his family. Until in 1992, he passed away.
So he was just a mere artisan, someone without much status or property, and he, through his craft, gained access to land. And
yes.
So interesting. So describe a Ghanaian funeral.
Funerals are really very huge and important to the Ghanaian community. It's an occasion where you meet very long relatives, people that you've never seen before, people living outside the country, people living very far from, you know, the city. They all come together during this occasion to pay their last respect to the deceased. It usually takes place from Fridays to Mondays. On Friday, they used to present the coffin to the relatives, I mean the family heads. Also, during the afternoon, they also have to bring the body all the way from the mortuary to home to prepare bathing and, you know, decorating it for the overnight. So the wakekeeping takes place in the evening of Friday till Saturday morning. And the burial takes place in the afternoon. If it's a chief or someone who represents the stool, it takes place at 6 o'clock in the evening. So on Sunday, then the family tends to give their last respect, I mean their thanksgiving, to families and friends who attended the funeral ceremony. And that is the occasion where you would see people offering a lot of, you know, donations to the family.
And they would be feeding these people?
Yes, they would be feeding them with food and drink. Yes.
Lots of drink.
Lots and lots of drink, yeah. And on Monday, the family has to gather and then account for whatever money which was donated and then whatever money which was spent on the funeral. And what is so special about that is, after doing all that, the one who spends much money or the one who buys the coffin is the person who automatically has to inherit whatever the person has. Normally, when I was growing up, I know it is the siblings. Like if I die, it is my brothers who are supposed to give a coffin, not my children. But now, due to civilization, it looks like everyone wants to, you know.
It's a competition.
Yeah, take a very good responsibility of their deceased person. Since my father gave me a good education, I want to give him a befitting burial. So it's really a competition for everyone to have a befitting burial.
This is good for your business, I imagine, this competition.
Yes, it is good for the business, of course. People arrive and they are ready to spend an amount on a coffin. And, you know, you just mention your price and they are like, we are ready to pay for that. But funerals are really huge. You have people ranging from maybe 500 to more than 1,000.
And that's a nice big audience for your work as well.
Oh, yes. And that's what also makes it more special because, you know, after spending a whole lot of days and weeks working on this piece, it finally ends up in the ground. But of course, with all these people paying attention, they are like, this guy was the one who built that coffin and I have a photo of it. So they recall that and they tend to come back to see you again.
So do you have a workshop full of other people helping you make these coffins?
At the moment, I have a workshop with 8 apprentices working with me.
So I think that's one thing that Eric talks about a lot is that it is a collaborative effort on all these.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes people might come, maybe not with a good idea of what they want, and you help them tease out maybe what they want.
That's one thing I basically have been working on a lot. When I meet a customer or someone comes into the shop, before they come, they have an idea of maybe a piece or two pieces of which the person could be buried in. So let's assume if the person is a cocoa farmer, they might choose the cocoa or something. So when I introduce the use of the laptops, I mean, like, I have all my photos on that. By showing that with them, they get a lot of trust in you, so they allow you to feel free and then choose something which could signify or represent the deceased. So based on that, you know, the communication becomes very easy and flowing. And I think you have the chances of deciding something they tend not to, like, refuse when it's done. And the only coffin that was refused from me, I mean, a woman died and she was noticed for bringing tomatoes from Bolgatanga, which is northern part of Ghana, to Accra. And the sisters tend to order a coffin in the shape of a tomato box filled with tomatoes. And that was one special coffin I've never done before. Initially, when they came, they wanted me to do the tomatoes. So I told them I've done that a couple of times, so we need to change the design. And this is going to a place which is more familiar with design coffins. So let's try to do something like the tomato box filled with tomatoes. I did that. It was a very nice, you know, piece. I mean, they really admired that. And when they got home, the children of the woman were living in the U.S., so they came for the funeral. And, of course, they bought a normal coffin from the U.S. to Ghana.
That's so interesting.
You know, so
we have very set ideas of what a coffin must look like.
Yes. It was really very tough. But finally, what happened was the family was stopped at this mortuary from picking the body on Friday afternoon. So the funeral couldn't go on. And then finally, they have to part ways. The children have to part ways with the family just because of the coffin. They don't want their mother to be buried in.
Right.
So the family disowned them, and they don't want to have anything to do with them.
Oh, that's too bad.
That is what makes it more interesting. I mean, that is what makes the whole use of coffin more interesting when you tend to meet people. Sometimes, you know, families tend to fight over coffins. An example was I also had two others, one in the shape of an eagle and then another one in the shape of a stool for just one chief because I didn't know they were coming from the same family. And then another one in the shape of the sword. Just for one person.
Okay, only one person, but three coffins.
Three coffins. And the reason was he has three wives with three different children. And they know the one who is supposed to buy the coffin is going to be, and normally it should be the senior son who provides the coffin. But all these children tend to be like, you know, to show their powers or how much they can spend on the funeral. So, you know, when it happens like that, normally in the beginning you don't know. But when you get to understand, I think it's better for you, being the artist, to let them know what is actually happening. Because, of course, you could take the money. But the issue is they are going to return two coffins to you, or they are going to keep whatever two coffins anywhere, which is not going to be used.
This sounds like a situation that really needs some kind of protocol, some sort of, you know, regular way that you always deal with it, or mediation.
Yeah. So when they approach and you get to understand that is the situation, you have the chance to speak with them. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't work. You know, sometimes they are like, we are ready to spend that money. Are you going to do it or not? So I basically did all the three coffins for them. And I don't know, I was invited for the funeral. Yeah, I was invited for the funeral. So it was on Friday, they have to present the coffin to the family. And I saw they had all my three pieces. They didn't know, each of them didn't know they ordered from me. So when I got to understand, then I approached them one-on-one. Like, so you have... this guy ordered that coffin from me, and you did the same. I mean, what are you going to do? You know, already, I have the money. That is part of my business. I've taken the money. I've you know, produced whatever I have to do. And finally, if they return the coffin, it's not necessarily I have to give them back their money. But what happens is sometimes they say, okay, when you sell the piece, you can refund the money. You know, sometimes they tend to donate the piece also to the shop. It's not really cool when it comes to that situation. And at a point in time, sometimes the bodies are even uncuffed and then back to the mortuary again. Hmm. Just because there are, you know, a whole
too
lot of conflicts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever created a coffin for a child or a baby?
No. These coffins I've been doing is meant to celebrate a life well lived. Hmm. That is what I basically do. So children are not buried in design coffins. People who died out of accidents are not buried in design coffins. Even though they might be responsible, it's considered as a sudden tragedy. Mm-hmm. So the family is a kind of feeling a lot of pain. You know, it's an accident. I mean, it has happened and he's very young and, you know, it's not the right time for him to die.
Right.
You see, that is how it is being seen. But the design coffins goes for people, let's say, 40 and above. And, you know, I've lived a very good life. I've got, you know, children who he has really given them a good education. So you could see normally when they passed away, the family goes for a meeting for like two or three times. And that is during that occasion, they try to plan on which coffin to use. But when it happens accidentally, like he was knocked down by a car, they don't have that much time or heart to sit and negotiate or talk about the coffin to be used. So in that case, they tend to use just a normal coffin. Mm. And the funeral also really doesn't take much time.
Oh, it's not as elaborate.
Yeah. And would you say that it's kind of more, you know, it's a tragedy, so there's less celebration of that life compared to the people who have lived that good life?
Yes.
So you're celebrating it, which includes the coffin and all of that. So.
Yeah.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're listening to Eric Ajite Anang of Ghana, a maker of design coffins. He's with Chris Martin, an ISU faculty member and furniture maker in the Iowa in the Integrated Studio Arts Program, whose class Eric will be working with all week long. Let's return to the interview. So did your father also do this?
My father is still working in the shop.
Okay.
Yeah. So I actually joined him. So my father was in Italy in 92. My grandfather raised some money for him to go and then, you know, in search of a greener pasture. And he went and then stayed for 2 weeks. And then he said to himself, I've got a good, you know, workshop at home. I can't come here and then starve and struggle just in search of a greener pasture. So he returned somewhere in February, and his dad passed away in June. So eventually they have to take over the shop. The boys are about five, so it is only two of them who seriously went under apprenticeship. So one passed away in 2000 and then was actually left with only my father. So he was the only one to have succeeded the shop.
And then comes you.
Yes. So I'm actually working together with him.
Do you often know the people who you're burying?
If you ask me to build an eagle and you are coming from the Ghana community, I have to be sure that person deserves that kind of a coffin. So on that occasion, I can refuse to build, which I did once, only once, since I've been in the shop for 9 years. So the guy was just a famous guy.
So he was being arrogant.
The family was being arrogant. Oh, okay. The family was saying more as a fan because he was just famous. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't represent anything. He's not a chief. He's not any of the lawmakers in the town. So the family just wanted, since he was famous and, you know, playing around, the family thought we could bury him in an eagle.
So, and the eagle's reserved for a chief.
I see.
So when I asked a few questions about that and then I noticed that was the guy they were going to bury in that, I said to them, you could choose any other bed or any other coffin, but not the eagle. Mm-hmm. And they tend to go to the other shop to order an eagle. But of course, that guy they ordered the coffin from learned from my grandfather, but he wasn't one of the best apprentices. So, of course, he took the order and he started building. And eventually, but of course, when a coffin appeared, it doesn't look like the eagle they were expecting to see.
Okay.
So
because it wasn't that skilled.
It wasn't an eagle. Yeah, that's the.
Was it a dolphin?
It was maybe a bird or something, okay. One of the birds.
At least it looked like
so
a bird.
So he tried to build an eagle, but he couldn't build the eagle. He built a bird. Yeah.
It's interesting that this is a tradition that has only sprung up in the last 40 so years.
60 years.
60 years. Mm-hmm. And yet there's already kind of a very rigid sense of what's right and what's wrong. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's more of the position a person is actually holding. And, you know, in a way, it also makes, I mean, the people around choose to live a kind of life, because if you are not good to people, you won't have good people during your funeral ceremony. And, you know, we also, in a way, say the bad people always try to order their coffins in advance. And, you know, it's important. To me, it's important you should be talking about your coffin, because that is the only thing you'll be going with, not with your mansions or with your beautiful car or whatever. It is your coffin. One problem I've been seeing most these days is a lot of the guys do not buy the design coffins anymore. And what I attribute that to is they can't afford to buy them. They feel it's too expensive. And they tend to buy just the normal-shaped coffin. And the reason is they claim they are Christians.
Oh.
So they try to attribute that as it is against the religion of the Christians to be buried in a design coffin. But that is not the whole issue. The whole issue is they can't afford to buy the coffin. I started 3 years ago to build the Bibles, you know, with different designs. Yeah. And last year, I built about 30 Bibles. And this year, before I left, I built already 20 Bibles. So it's becoming the tradition of the Christians now. So when you tell me your dad is a Christian, so you don't want to bury him in a design coffin, what do you mean? You tell me it's against your religion.
Maybe against their sect.
So, you know, we have tribes like the Ashantis who are very, very, very wealthy. And even if they don't have education, they tend to share among themselves. So whenever it's time for a funeral or something, it's not a matter of one person's problem, but it's a matter of a huge family who tends to come together to organize for such occasions. But among the guns, it always relies on the children who are supposed to put their efforts and finance the whole thing.
That's a particular tribe?
Yeah, that's a particular tribe.
The Ga.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's actually the tribe I'm coming from.
Mm. Oh.
Yeah, I'm a Ga.
No.
Yeah.
And where do you live? In a city or in a village?
I live in the city, a suburb of Accra, so maybe 20 minutes away from the center of Accra.
It's right on the coast. Beautiful place.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, any other interesting coffin stories for us?
What's the strangest coffin you ever made?
The strangest?
Yeah.
So a family dropped one day and they were like, my brother ordered a coffin in another shop and we refused and we just have 1 week for the burial. So they were in the shop on Saturday and the burial is supposed to take place the next Saturday.
And normally you have much more time.
Yeah, I mean you have a month or 2 months or more. And this was just a week. So he said to me, I'm thinking if you can build a ray fish. And I'm like, if it was the tuna, I could have done it, but a ray fish, ray manta, I mean the flat one.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, a ray. Oh.
So I'm like, I've never done that before, and 5 days is really short. And he's like, if you can do that, I can pay this amount, you know, like, and I'm like, if that's the situation, let's see. So it took me 3 days to have an idea of how the whole shape is going to be like, because I'm like, how do I, you know, start it?
Construct it, yeah.
Yeah. So it is very important. I mean, when it comes to the construction, I have to think about it and then have the shape in mind. So while building, I keep visualizing. And during that time, I didn't know how to use the internet much. So I called a friend in France and then asked him to search on the internet and then look for the fish for me and then send me an image. So I was looking on it. So for 3 days, and then I had to build that within 2 days. So the coffin was actually taken from the shop on Friday, Saturday morning, and then it will be buried in Saturday afternoon. So it was actually not dried when they took it from the shop, but they just love it.
Cool.
They love it. So when they were picking it from the shop, we couldn't wrap it. It was just put on the back of a flat, so while on the way going, it will be dried, which is not usually common. Normally what they do is when they are taking the coffin from the shop, they keep the design or the shape away from the public.
Oh, right.
So people will be, that is a fish. No, that is a lion, you know. So that is also what makes it more special to rest, because when you go to a funeral and people don't know what they are going to use, and you, the artist, feels like, you know, wow, that's my work they are talking about. Mm. And, you know, it makes it more special.
Right.
So usually when someone asks me a question like, how do you feel when your coffin is going to under the ground or something? I say, I would really love people to be talking about my coffin more, and then even to the extent of making another whenever they lose a dear one, than to loan or to sell a piece to someone that I never get to see.
Hmm. So that sounds like it would take a very big hole to dig.
Array. Yeah.
What I basically do is sometimes I try as much as possible so some parts could be broken. So like...
You mean of the coffin, not the person.
Of the coffin. So something like the fish, which is 11 feet, they can try to break the tail, which is maybe 2 feet or something. So you could have the hole to be 9 feet or something.
Oh, you design it to be collapsible.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's nice. Hmm. This is very fascinating.
Yeah.
A complete new world for us. Have you sold any to U.S. customers?
Yes. Actually, there is a piece of my grandfather in the Seattle Art Museum in the shape of the Mercedes, and then also another one in the junk, that is the Cocoa Pot. And then
museum in San Francisco.
Yeah. And then I've sold a couple of pieces myself, like the Linen Kugel to Delaware, the beer.
Linen Kugel, a Liney's bottle.
Oh.
To Delaware. And then now I'm working on a piece that is a seahorse, which is about 9 feet tall. And this guy wants it in Florida and wants to be buried in that when he passed away.
He actually wants to be buried in it. Mm-hmm. Will that be a first, someone actually being buried in the U.S. in one of your coffins?
Good question.
Maybe yes. Yes. I came with a piece which was about 5 feet tall in the form of a seahorse. I mean, I got an email 2 weeks before coming here, and she wrote to me, I want a coffin in the shape of a seahorse. So I was like, I'm coming to the U.S. in 2 weeks. I can't do that. And she was like, I'm going to pay you this amount, and I need it badly. I'm at the hospital now.
Oh.
And I'm like, you are at the hospital? For what? And she said, yeah, I have cancer, and, you know, I know I'm going to, but I'm a very big fan of yours, and I need a coffin from you. So
this is somebody in the U.S.?
In the U.S., New York.
Uh-huh.
So I built the piece, which was about 5 feet. So I came with it with me. I built it within a week and then came with it. And then she collected that at Philadelphia. Hmm. And she's going to be cremated. So I'm not really sure, but I think I have to be in touch with her before I leave.
Yeah. Eric Adjetey Anang, the design coffin artist, will be in Ames all week. In fact, he will be presenting a slideshow of his art at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of Memorial Union tonight, Monday night. That's 8 p.m. in Memorial Union. Anyway, Susan, I've been kind of stuck on this idea of 3D printers and what they can do. And in fact, the bike designer I spoke with, Mark Cargill, showed me a bicycle part that he had designed and then printed out with a 3D printer. So, of course, you know what I had to ask this Ghanaian woodworker whose workshop, by the way, does have a few power tools, but probably not as many as your husband Fritz's basement wood shop does. I thought his response was rather interesting. Have you seen a 3D printer in work?
So I saw that at Ishtak, and okay. I saw some of the work of the 3D.
Okay.
And I think that is one of the problems we're having in Ghana with the screen printing.
Screen printing?
Yeah.
Okay.
It has taken all the job away from the artists.
Really?
From the painters, the sign writers. When I was growing up, I knew to make the sign boards, they have to get some paint and then do on wood or something.
Mm-hmm.
But now they tend to go to the Chinese and then, you know, they have to pay some few money and then.
Hmm.
So let's keep the 3D printers out of Ghana.
No way.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure talking
to you. Yeah. Same to me. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio on 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. We heard from Ed Fallon of the Fallon Forum, who is walking across the country with a bunch of other people to help bring attention to the crisis of climate change.
We'll be checking with Ed all week as he fast forwards from Indiana to New York City, where there will be a weekend of community action around climate change.
We also heard from Mark Cargill, who is working with others on ISU's bike share program, and from Eric Adjetey Anang, a design coffin maker from Ghana, who is presenting a slideshow of his work this evening at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Student Union.
We've been your hosts, Susan Franzen and Greta Anderson. Rick Morrison engineered the show. Our theme song is Backtrackin' from Al Harris and Tom Richards' CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard a clip from the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org.
KHOI is now streaming live on the web at khoifm.org, so you can keep up with all that's afoot in Story County, even when you're elsewhere.
As always, your participation as audience and your generous donations help make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again
on the radio.